Welcome to Tales for Our Times. I am your host, Dougie Mackay, professional storyteller based here in the mystical heartlands of Scotland. In this podcast, we will explore the role of folk culture, myths, legends, and storytelling in the creation of a better world. As well as sharing my favourite tales for telling, I'll be interviewing some of the finest storytellers, changemakers, rebels, and poets, inspiring people bringing their creative gifts to respond to the complexities and turbulence of these times. How can storytelling support the great turning as we shift from a culture focused only on growth and consumption to one that is regenerative, creative, and supportive of life on this planet? Grab yourselves a brew, throw another peat on the imaginal hearth fire, and watch the flames dance as we dream a better world into being. All of it starting once upon a time. Greetings and welcome to the show. It's early spring 2024, and for today's episode, I've got another interview to present. Recently, I caught up with my storytelling friend, Dan Serridge. Originally from the north of England, as you will hear from his accent, but now residing in Glasgow and very much settled there. I'm going to keep the introduction fairly brief because the interview is quite a lengthy one. We got kind of carried away reminiscing about old times, talking about storytelling in theatres, storytelling in community. We talked about upcoming events in Europe and in Glasgow. We also talked about some of his storytelling shows, which involved walking the borderline between Scotland and England, journeying to the other world and back with Thomas the Rhymer, and pondering the bardic journey of olden times. We talk about grief and loss and how they were mirrored a little bit through the Orpheus myth, the Greek myth. And there is talk about folktale and myth as a way of relating to grief and loss. There's also a great deal of humour and foolishness. There is a whole feast of fools or fiesta of fools story selection that is referenced, and a story from that salty menu at the end of the interview. There are a few riddles to lighten the journey and some commentary on what we would call applied storytelling, how to use stories and storytelling for benefit in communities. One of the reasons I wanted to get Dan on the show, well, firstly, he's got the gift of the gab. He's got the gift of chat, of blethering, as we might say. But what I feel is more unique is how he's really rooted in this community practice of storytelling. He's out working with all kinds of different groups in Glasgow several days a week and has been doing so for many, many years. And there's something about honing the craft of storytelling that can only happen through the doing of it. We might talk and share fanciful ideas about storytelling. We might go and do training. We might do online courses about storytelling. But there's something that we can only develop through the doing of it. And I've always been impressed by Dan's commitment to storytelling in communities, and he's able to work with so many different groups at any different time. And I think that really has affected his practice and shows in his manner of storytelling. We worked together for 18 months or so, and definitely that time in Glasgow was really formative for my own storytelling development. It was a real gift to be around other storytelling enthusiasts. We would, share professional development together, but also just being out telling stories through that time was really formative. in many ways, Glasgow is a really natural storytelling city. It's the sort of place where people do just speak to you in the street, they speak to you in the bus. Everyone got a willingness almost to talk. But it's also the sort of place where if people are bored, they will let you know. So storytelling in Glasgow, in Glaswegian schools, can be a bit of a baptism of fire. And I've got a certain amount of respect for anyone who's cutting their creative teeth in such a place. As we touch upon through this interview. So, without further introduction, here is my conversation with community storyteller and theatre practitioner Dan Serage. Welcome, Daniel. Good to speak to you this morning. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Hello. Lovely to be here. It's really nice to spend the morning chatting, which I'm sure we'll do.
Yes. It's the intention was to meet at 9:30 and start the interview. We've managed to talk for an hour already without even getting close to the interview starting. So
we should have just recorded from the start, you know, and
It's been riveting. So if you're listening in, you've missed out on some real storytelling gold, but hopefully we'll be able to recapture some of that through the following chat. As you might guess, there is a familiarity with myself and Dan Serage. We worked together for a year or so through in Glasgow with the Village Storytelling Centre. And in fact, often would get mistaken for each other. And to my eyes, we don't look alike, but to the eyes of your average Glaswegian pupil, we are identical. And often I would find myself walking through a corridor in a school in Glasgow, and people would be running up behind me going, Dan, it's you. And I would then turn around and see the disappointment etched across their face when they realised I wasn't the one and only Dan Serage.
Can I give two examples of this exact phenomenon? Because I feel like there's two very key examples. The first and the most recent was at your recent show. After the performance, someone who you were performing with tried to give me money to pay me. And I was like, I wasn't in it. And then the second example, which I think is really telling, is talking of familiarity, Dougie knows me so well. He came to my wedding. On my wedding day, as I'm waiting to go up to it wasn't an altar. It was outside. It was in the forest. I saw the celebrant who was doing my wedding go up to Dougie and ask how he was feeling because he had been mistaken for me. So it's good to know that even in the big moments that we are very similar.
I thought you had a very considerate celebrant that was concerned at how I was feeling.
Yeah. Or maybe she was, but I do think that I think we sit within a trope. Maybe we are, in terms of story, we are an archetype. I'm not sure what that is, but we are one of them.
Probably the fool, if we're being honest. Or something.
The balding, fair-haired fool. That's a new name.
Yeah, so as we say, we met in, you're in Glasgow, you're still in Glasgow. I'm in another part of Scotland. Can you give us a bit of an introduction to where we find you and what's special about your part of the world?
So, yeah, I'm in Glasgow. I've been here now for coming up to 12 years. I'm sitting in my spare room surrounded by maps, and this room endlessly seems to not get any light. I don't know if that's indicative of Glasgow, but I often see people on conversations online that have beautiful sun streaming in, and it never seems to happen here. But I'm in Shorelands, the south side of Glasgow, and I've always been in the south side of Glasgow. I love it. I fell in love with Glasgow very quickly, and then fell in love with someone else, and then had two children, and I'm just totally settled. And I think what I loved about this place was its sense of people and its sense of connection and its rootedness in its own history and folk culture. It feels unique, but that doesn't mean it's not comparable to other British cities, you know. So I was born in Liverpool, got a lot of Scousers in my family. So there was sort of an innate sense of connection I felt with the ways people communicate, the atmosphere, the sense of humor, and a kind of working class culture that sort of drew me in. I spent some time thinking about those two things as a storyteller, thinking about, are these things that are innate, or are we making them up? Am I making these connections based on kind of just perceived assumption? But I do think there's something incredibly special about the way in which communities from industrial centres articulate their identity to each other. Mm. And I've been able to mix it, even in the kind of perceived. I also think there's an underdog. It's an underdog feeling as well that I really love, despite living in Shorelands, which is sort of palatial, hipster paradise, really.
Hipster paradise. Yeah, there is what I've enjoyed in Glasgow. I also studied in Glasgow, so it's been a really formative city for me, is people's willingness to speak. You know, in terms of an everyday storytelling culture, Glasgow's really got it. And as you say, there are other places like it too. Maybe it's being a port city or an industrial city, being on the other side of the Irish Sea, people coming back and forward. There's a down-to-earthness in Glasgow where actually it's... some of my favorite storytelling projects have been with elderly people in Glasgow who I find thoroughly entertaining, thoroughly real in a way that's, I feel, increasingly precious in the modern world.
Absolutely. And I think that what you get is for me, it's an example of expertise of place. I talk about it a lot within community context, within applied storytelling, which we've spoken about a little bit, in terms of working with communities, about how, as an outsider, as an offcomer, whatever you call it, you are placing the expertise and skills and stories into the hands of the people who own them, in their mouths, in their words, in their language. And with Glasgow, there is a kind of deep understanding of their local history and the kind of social interactions that have occurred over the years. So most old people, they're very happy to communicate about the dances and the cinemas and the gangs and, you know, all this kind of folklore that's innate in the city. People communicate with such authenticity, and that's what I kind of really like about it.
Yeah. And as you hinted at with the gangs, there is a real roughness and a wildness in Glasgow where you need to have your wits about you, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain level of edge, maybe, but the problem is it is both to its advantage, because it's able to kind of to be able to be many different things to many different people. It suffers from it because whenever I tell people, you know, down south, or talk to people about living in Glasgow, there's a sort of 1970s, 1980s perception of how it is. So trying to demystify that, yet also be aware that, you know, there is edge as well, but I like that.
Yeah, you kind of need a bit of street smart, and you also need the gift of the gab to get by in Glasgow.
I mean, I don't know where this conversation is going to go, but it reminds me, all of this stuff is really interesting in relation to working in Barhead, Borhead, and the relationship between me coming in and the kind of process of acceptance that has taken place. And it takes a certain level of steel to deal with the communication styles of a place like that in what they refer to as the scheme in Barhead. That's their language, not mine. And it's been kind of noticeable how much steel I have needed at points to know that that's kind of the normal ways of communicating. There is a love language that is, it can be easily confused, I think, with with not love, but it is there. I'm not saying it's lacking in dysfunction. I think there's an element of dysfunction in there too.
Yeah.
But it's also so culturally rich if you can burst through the barriers or begin to understand that that's the way that, you know, this interaction takes place.
Yeah. There's this idea of like ribbing each other or like winding each other up and banter. And actually part of the playfulness is like kind of giving each other a push. I think parts of Scotland and Glasgow, especially, is somewhere that likes to give you a wee jab and see if you're up for that and giving a little jab back. And that's actually how friendships are made.
I feel like there's two phrases in Glasgow. There's more, but there's something in the language of Glasgow that suggests that. There's one is a joke we a jag, right? Which I don't think there's a phrase that exists like that in other places. If there is, that's great. But the joke we a jag feels very appropriate in that there's something at the center of it that I'm trying to push at, which feels like it links into a lot of sort of fool narratives, Shakespeare fool and beyond, that kind of sense of, I will make a joke, but I'm getting at something here. And then the other one is, I know your father or I know your father. Uh-huh. That sense that don't get above yourself, mate, because we will bring you down.
We
know where you're from. And it's that, and that is, there is an element of kind of negativity around that phrase, definitely. But also it's that kind of the importance of grounding, I guess, or the importance of kind of knowing where you've come from and knowing when you're like living your life with authenticity or whatever.
Yeah, there's a kind of rootedness. So we kind of touched on, we used that term applied storytelling, which to some people will make no sense. But also you've highlighted that, you've arrived in Glasgow and now you're working in communities, that we know each other from working in storytelling community projects. So, could we very briefly demystify applied storytelling, maybe talk about a couple of projects you're involved with just now that you think are exciting? And if you want to, I'm also kind of curious about that process of arriving from the north of England and getting a joke we a jag and needing to become the Steely Dan that we know today.
Great link. I hadn't even thought of that. How could I not have thought of a Steely Dan when I use the word steel? So I suppose the kind of clearest place to start is, I've always worked in communities. So before I would have actively used the term storyteller, I was working in the northwest of England, in Cumbria, for Theatre by the Lake in Keswick in the West Coast, working in Whitehaven, Maryport, post-industrial, cut off by the mountains in many respects, trying to develop theatre processes, street theatre processes to a certain degree, and working with, under the stewardship, I guess, of Ian Douglas and Jeff Walcook. I'm going to give a mention out to him as well because he's been very important in my journey. And story was incredibly relevant at that point because there was this idea around the story tree or story tree, in which there was a geodesic dome that traveled around and we sat underneath the boughs of a tree made from metal and felt. But I discovered early on that for me, story instantly demystified this sort of separation between performer and audience, or between storyteller and listener, between people coming in and people who live there, because you are able to interact with their responses to what you're doing. And storytelling had that ability to sit anywhere. So fast forward to now, over a period of a number of years, understanding a variety of different community contexts, group dynamics, facilitation, how to build relationships with people quickly, but also with authenticity and integrity and a focus on their needs and responding to their needs as best you can, making yourself vulnerable, making yourself open to things changing and shifting based on your prejudices and biases and what have you. It sort of emerged that theatre shifted to storytelling for me kind of around 12 to 13 years ago. And this applied term begins to not exclusively then, but there's been a need to maybe define a little bit what we mean by working in these contexts. Applied storytelling as a term is very much the key term across a lot of Europe. And although it's contentious in some respects, it attempts to describe story being used with intention and purpose to support people sharing and telling their story as a way of separating out from the classic trope of storyteller turns up, tells stories and leaves, which has immense value. But this is about a bit more ingratiating yourself or being part of, for a small period of time, a community. Theatre, out of interest, has gone on that journey with Applied. Applied Theatre was attached to theatre, and then there was kickback and people, and then it was dropped a little bit. So, there's a journey with these terms, and I'm always interested in supporting the kind of challenges of those terms. But it very much goes a journey in describing what's occurring with communities and story. And so that's sort of how I ended. Well, it's not really how I ended up, but communities and applied work and working with people has always been at the center of everything that I've done.
Yeah. So I can hear there's that kind of straddling of both theater and storytelling moving from one to the other. And of course, the boundaries between these two forms blur at times. I think we will go on to talk about that as each of us kind of explore performance storytelling. I'm really curious, as you were talking, like, do you have, if, for example, you were going into a new community and you got a sense, whether it's, young people or people from a certain geographical area or whatever, community can mean many different things. Could be a community of interest or geographical community. Have you got certain stories or activities that you go to that you're like, these are your safe ones? You've got your little kind of short list of stories that even if things are out of your comfort zone, this story is likely to be a winner. And could you just name a couple of them? Because that's, for me, something I'm curious about.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really interesting, that feeling, because sometimes with stories that you know really well and things you know really well, the context within which you supply it gives it a freshness. So when you know it's something good, something can be sort of overdone, can't it? And you can feel too familiar with stuff. But when you're entering spaces that are, let's face it, hostile or could be, to know that this is something that it works incredibly well and can be used to your advantage, it's like a little lifeline. And with facilitation and story, it's about that tool bag and building a tool bag, so you don't know what you're going to do, but you know that you've got the tools. So stories, I mean, Jack's Fantastic Journey, absolutely 100% story that I was one of the first stories I ever heard and learnt. The Angus's story, the Six Silly Fishermen story, that works incredibly well. I mean, Red Caps, the story that you tell, I've heard you tell, and I've told about the old witches. The witchy women who end up in London. There's Heart and Beard, I know works really, really well, which I love. There is, now it becomes me trying to recall lists of different things.
So Jack's Fantastic Journey, that's not the one where he puts the kind of the milk in his pocket. It's not the silly Jack.
No. Although Lazy Jack's also a really good one. It starts similarly. He starts with a boy, Jack, who gets told to get out of his bed. He goes on this remarkable journey around the sun and across the sea. And it's a story that I think I put to pasture sometimes because it's so strong. That sometimes it loses its luster. So I give it, it's good to give it years away.
Yeah, to, a fallow and it's year. Interesting,
a little fallow year, let the ground settle on it and stuff, and fall in love with it a little bit again, because there's a danger that that it works and it becomes very popular that you do it in several places. So I try and do that with lots of stories. Is, you know, you some stories that I told when I was younger, they don't fit me anymore, they don't work anymore. That one goes through phases, but I know that within difficult, even so, teens, a lot of people struggle with working with teens and teenagers, and it's a frightening context because you have to constantly be comfortable in the awkwardness of it, like. The whole awkwardness of working with teens is just written all over you. It's written all over the space. It's just constant, right? But I know that even with the reticence that we all feel when you tell groups who aren't expecting you and don't necessarily want you to be there, I'm going to tell you a story. Mm. And the feeling in the group when you say that and you can feel the tension, I've started to love that tension, you know. This is, we can talk about this a little different day, but I love that awkwardness. I know that story will break free of people's sort of skepticism quickly. And it is interesting that, like, you are, a lot of it is about breaking boundaries or breaking barriers between you and this art form, because the art form can be easily dismissed as for children. Or irrelevant in our times, and that's what you're sort of wading through. Whether the person is conscious of that or not, you feel it in their bodies.
Hmm. So what's the power? I kind of promised we wouldn't talk about this too much, but what is the opportunity with stories to break down barriers? Why do they break down barriers?
That is a big question. Going beyond it, human sort of desire for story and human need for them, whether it be through storytelling or through other means, we are all actively sort of searching for meaning and searching for the meaning in what we're doing. I think when it comes to oral storytelling, what it attempts to do, or what it can do, is it positions a piece of art at the top of some communication in some respects. Mm. I think it offers something. It's not coming in cold. You're not coming in empty handed. Mm. And I mean that metaphorically as opposed to physically. You are offering something, and it's through that offering that you are almost inciting people to respond. A beautiful thing happens with story, which, you know, when someone tells one, everyone wants to share on that theme or offer something. And that might be quietly. There might be somebody in the corner that's really unsure about joining in, but they can listen to 5, 6, 10, 15 stories over the course of 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks. And it might be by the final week, they then feel like they've got that desire to contribute. But it's through that offering of something, laying ourselves out there, being vulnerable. Like, I talk about this a lot with people coming into the profession, emerging storytellers and otherwise, this vulnerability that's constant in our work, where you are putting yourself in front of groups of people all the time. But through that vulnerability, by telling a story, there is a desire to come out of your shell, to move closer, to feel something within its content, to need to respond. And to me, it sort of links back to a lot of, and this is purely me, a number of theatre practitioners that I'll have worked with and that I will have studied in the past, about trying to remove barriers between, like, stage and audience. It's how do you make an audience? How do you make a group of people feel the need to contribute, like, be almost unavoidable, kind of like, I am invested here. And story does that quicker than anything else. And I think it is within the vulnerability of the performer, but it is also within the story itself, providing us with peril, problems, laughs, mistakes, embarrassment, you know, all the fundamentals of challenge that we can get on board with. People connect.
Nice. Yeah, I love the idea of, like, story as a gift, and it being something that is really easy for us to carry about. And sometimes I riff on this old idea of story as currency. And actually, if you were someone traveling, if you were someone wandering from town to town, village to village, if you carried story, you brought something that is really portable that will be welcomed and might result in you being offered shelter, food, like really tangible things. But I also love this idea of story as an invitation, and that it invites a response. I've heard before stories can be reciprocal. You know, when you tell a story, you're licensing someone else to tell one in return, whether it's a comparable myth or folktale or a personal reflection or whatever. So, yeah, maybe there's something in that, the invitation. And as you've hinted at, sometimes with certain communities or social groups, that may take a number of weeks for people to really speak back. But it's there's a potency in story in drawing out the values, beliefs, life experience of all kinds of different people.
And for me, it's through its sparseness that it allows you to do that. That the emptiness of the story, as well as its fullness, provides people the space in a world where space is at a premium and time for your brain to switch off is rare, to be given a series of unfolding events, whether it be archetypes or whether it be this happened, then this happened, to be given the bare bones of something through which I can layer on my meaning openly and with encouragement. It's not like, it differs from film in the way that the film has been directed and shot to make us feel certain things. Story offers us this blank, this sparse canvas for us to make meaning with. And that's why it goes straight to the heart of people, because they're instantaneously making connections to their own life, whether they're whether wittingly or unwittingly, which of course makes them want to share, because they're making those connections in the moment. Also, to jump off what you've just said, I've done a lot of talk thinking recently about warmth. This was partly last year because there was all this cost of living crisis, which is still going on, conversations with regard to warm hubs and this like need for warmth. And obviously a lot of the conversation is like, you know, getting people into warm rooms that are where the heating's already on. And it's made me think about how warmth is more than a temperature. It's more than, the feeling of just being inside. It's in the invitation to be involved, to feel human. And it's that kind of, there's no kind of worse feeling in terms of like, there's no sort of greater way to make people feel less human than to like remove their body temperature, to lower their body temperature. So how do you bring that up through story? How do you make people feel warm? And words and tales and an offering provides that, because they're being stimulated, not just externally, but internally as well.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, as you talked about the sparseness of story, like there is a lot of space. You know, I feel like as an audience, we get to work a little bit for the story. We get to, an audience comes up with their own reflections, interpretation, our own imagery in a way that, yeah, something like film or even a book might not fully. There's a lot of space, there's a lot of sparseness. And it made me think of this space to daydream. Like I think an audience is allowed to daydream in and out of the story, and there being something quite powerful about it being almost like a collective daydream as we listen to stories in a group. Mm-hmm. And then with your point about warmth, how almost like storytelling traditionally is synonymous with the fire, with the hearth. Like this is the This is the human act that happens when we gather around a fire. It's a very primal association. Mm-hmm, so yeah, maybe mm-hmm. it's no accident. Maybe it's no surprise that you find yourself kind of musing warmth and gathering space.
Absolutely. And I suppose, you know, the space in those moments, you know, what works incredibly well in the fire, around the fire, is that there is but the fire to watch, and there's the ears to listen to the story. So, you know, you'd get those probably drops in talking where people stare, and it still happens when you're around a campfire, that sense of just staring, and it's okay for the silence to exist. It's very rare now for it to be okay for silence to be okay. Mm. And that feels like a throwback, you know, it feels like a throwback to something very sort of base, very human, like you say. And it's, you know, a lot of what the modern profession is attempting to do is to capture that. Mm. And yes, the need to professionalize that, but also that just to create that feeling of something so sort of fundamental.
Mm. And so we've talked about storytelling in a community setting. We've talked a little bit about storytelling as opposed to theatre. I think both of us are rooted in community storytelling, but ultimately find ourselves working on storytelling shows, storytelling pieces, bringing together a sequence of stories or overarching narrative that will entertain people at a festival or, yeah, whether it be the Fringe or a storytelling festival. You've got at least, yeah, you've got a whole bag full of shows actually now that you've developed over the last few years. You've got a couple of children's shows, which I've seen, which have been really popular, but also you've got some more contemplative adult shows. You've got, was it The Two Truths of Thomas the Rhymer?
Mm-hmm.
And also Orpheus Orfeo. And my understanding is each of those, you weave your own personal experience and personal narrative with existing folktales and myths. Could you give us just a little flavor of how you've approached those two shows, or which stories show up and how they speak to your life experience?
Yeah, sure. So they're slightly different in the sense that, yes, Thomas the Rhymer weaves much more actively personal stories within the narrative, whereas Orpheus Orfeo is a bit more metaphorical. But I'll talk about the processes. So Thomas the Rhymer spilled out of a piece of master's research that I was doing in 2015. I was interested, you may recall 2015 as being an interesting political landscape, perhaps less so. Yeah. Unless it was pre-Brexit, it was post-Indie Ref,
yeah.
And it was also around the time of that general election in which Scotland turned yellow and most of England seemed to turn blue, and it felt like there was a huge disparity on a national level between the countries. There was the sense of positivity potentially up north in some locations, and there was a sense of sort of doom on the left down south, I would say. But I was interested in its relationship to story, and I decided, and I've always been interested in walking practice. We could talk about walking practice and walking as a way of engaging with landscape, engaging with environment, and also the rhythms of movement, and that sense of walking with somebody, not looking at them talking, and how that creates this level of comfort in the same way we talk about looking at the fire. So, but I wanted to challenge myself. So I decided to try and walk. And I've always been interested in maps and mapping. You can't see at home, but behind me is a whole wall of maps because I'm interested in outlines and structures and how things are mapped and the complexities of that and bordering and how bordering can create culture and where borders are enacted and where they're not enacted. So anyway, I decided to walk the line of the border between England and Scotland, trying to plant my feet exactly along the line, and on the way call into pubs and a variety of locations and tell the story of Thomas the Rhymer, because I discovered there were some interesting ideas within that story around nationhood, leaving your own country and not getting back, and what that means, following the right path, silence and truth, and losing a sense of self through our ingratiation with another culture, those kind of things. So I thought, oh, I'll go with this story and I'll tell it and I'll engage people in conversations around unionism and nationalism. Halfway round, I started to make this quite deep personal connection to where I was and the content of the story. And so what emerged following that piece of research, after I failed, I had to get the bus at one point, just spoilers. I created this show that wove together the walk with the folk tale and this set of disparate personal, this very personal narrative that exists alongside it, roughly around a single moment from my own life, that was used to frame some of the content. So they wove together these three ideas, and I've done it with musicians. In fact, I did it alongside James Spence originally. He's a lovely Borders storyteller, but it's come to now be a solo piece that I did at Fate last year. Mm. And then Orpheus. So that piece go on.
So it's really nice to hear the process and this kind of interweaving of folktale, of personal experience, and of socio-political, ecological landscape, and these three threads weaving together. I'm just aware that we have a familiarity with the story Thomas the Rhymer, but maybe some people don't. So, I know it roughly. Could we get a brief synopsis? Just kind of what happens, the bare bones of it.
Yeah, sure. So Thomas, it's based around a supposed true tale of Thomas Erceldoune, or Thomas of Erceldoune, who could play the harp, very good harpist, and would often go off and walk the Eildon Hills. In the story, he's off playing one day, he falls asleep, and then when he wakes up, he's confronted by this beautiful woman on a horse, white horse, and turns out she's the queen of the fairies. She gets off the horse and she asks him if he wants a kiss. He says, "I will then." And they have a kiss. And then she says, "Well, now you've kissed, you have to come back with me and spend 7 years in Elfland, Fairyland." And he goes, "Oh, all right then." Totally enamored by this beauty. He jumps on the horse and they ride across the countryside. And she points out a variety of different sort of landmarks. There's a river of blood. There's a river of tears. There's paths that are strewn with thorns. There's paths that are broad and wide and inviting, which is sort of the paths to salvation and the path to sort of debauchery and what have you. And then there's this road, and they ride this road to the fairyland. And in my version, the horse takes off and goes through the clouds and then arrives again. And then he ends up at this, basically this party, as often happens in Scottish folklore. He ends up at this fairy party with the queen, and he's told he can't speak. You know, do not say a single word, because if you speak, you'll be here for the rest of your life. So he has to sit at the edge of this party that I, in the version that I tell, because I'm interested in the darkness, turns progressively more disturbing. And he has to survive it, basically. And he gets through the night, and the queen comes up to him and says, "Thanks, Thomas, you've done it." And he's about to speak, and she stops him and says, "I know. It was at one night in Fairyland, his 7 years at home." She takes him back, drops him at the tree. He wakes up, he walks back into town, and obviously he's disappeared for 7 years. People don't know him. But when he comes back, he starts to prophesy certain things. Apparently he predicts Bannockburn, and he predicts a variety of different things, and he becomes known as True Thomas, because he tells truths. Oh, but because before he says goodbye to the queen, she gives him an apple. And if he bites the apple, it gives him the tongue that can't lie. So he does. True Thomas. And then eventually he's called back to Elfland, either by a deer or by something else, but at some point he disappears and nobody sees him again. Mm. And that's it, really.
Nice. Nice to hear it with those extra little embellishments that I didn't know. Is it right that he, when he comes back, he speaks in rhyme?
Oh, yes. That also makes sense. Yeah, Thomas the Rhymer. Yeah, he delivers. There is an element of delivery within what he tells that is rhyming. I don't know those rhymes, and rhymes don't feature very heavily in my telling, but yes, it makes sense that that is his name.
For me, it's kind of fascinating from that storytelling element that when he goes to this other world, he needs to be silent, you know, and I guess like just observe and just, I don't know, be initiated into this other world. Yet when he returns, he has something. Do you think it's hinting at a kind of bardic culture, like speaking in rhyme and telling the truth in a kind of slightly obscure way? It feels like there's a kind of rich archetypal motif there.
Totally. And it makes me wonder about like what was told by people who were part of either a bardic or other traditions, because they would have disappeared for huge swathes of time and potentially come back with skills in wordplay and music and other things. And how mysterious that must have been for people to be confronted by effectively a completely different personality. Yes, maybe an entertaining personality, and with knowledge, with wisdom. But like, if you've never left your village and then someone who's gone away and comes back and they are transformed, like that must feel like magic. Yeah. That must feel like complete magic. And that's amazing. And it sort of reminds me of when you go back to your hometown where you grew up and you feel different. You feel like who you are is greater because you have learned, you've gained, you've experienced, you're more scarred, you know, all those things have made you who you are, but you don't feel like the place has changed. So there's this sense of, well, what is the truth here? Where does the truth exist in this relationship? There must be something within how bards and others, traveling storytellers and other performers, raconteurs, picked up these things mysteriously and came back. But it's not that mysterious. If you're away for 7 years, you can get pretty good at something in that period of time. So
a lot can pass. Because I guess it makes sense to contextualize these stories and think, they're coming in a time where people didn't have the freedom of travel that we do today. So things would have been hyper-localized for better or for worse. And to travel would have been akin to some kind of magical power in a way.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks for giving us a little insight into Thomas the Rhymer.
I'll just say as well, like there are various different versions. There'll be very traditional versions that I have that will probably tell it with much greater, you know, truth, quote unquote, than I. So, as someone who respects the tradition and the culture, I know that I have played with some of the elements of that narrative.
Oh, Daniel, you're a storytelling heathen. and on to Orpheus Orpheo, because I missed that sadly at the Scottish International Storytelling Festival last year. I'd kind of overdone it and couldn't bear another trip into Edinburgh on that particular day, but by all accounts it went really well. I heard good things about it. What was the premise there? Which stories were you playing with?
So two, basically. So I suppose what drops out of Thomas the Rhymer is themes slightly of loss and grief and also what's left behind, that sense of what's left behind. And grief and loss are something that I've very much been interested in as I've got older and into my career a bit more. And when I had my child, when I had Finn, who's my boy, he's nearly six, we got delved more deeply into Greek myth and just reading very childlike versions of them. And to rediscover after the years, the Orpheus story, It just stayed with me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I found myself coming back to the pain of it. It was the pain at the center of the story, or the end of the story, that remained for me. And I'd longed to tell it. I'd longed to tell it for that reason, that just it kept calling me. It felt like a true expression of sort of artistic need, really. It never felt like I wanted to just tell the Orpheus story, because it's sort of well known, but also not. And I wanted to do something different with it. So I discovered that there was a ballad that was supposedly written in Shetland, in Unst, that is roughly based around a English or pan-British, pan-Scottish tale called Sir Orfeo. There's a ballad called King Orfeo. That tells of a king who loses his queen to fairyland. Here we are, we're going back into fairyland. And him going into fairyland with his harp and basically persuading the king of the fairies to give her back. And what I find interesting in the two stories is one is filled with, is pretty bleak. It doesn't end well, and the other is pretty hopeful. And I'm interested in what is a true reflection of people's grief journeys and grieving journeys, and how do we not approach necessarily, but how do we as humans respond to this fundamental part of our lives, which is the end of it. And the end of people's lives, we have to deal with it. And the language of it is, especially in Britain, is one of distance, and is one of safety around something that hurts, painful. And so I just wanted to play with those two narratives together, and that's what I did. I sort of smooshed them in a way. It was a smooshing.
And do you find So you found some kind of way of approaching death and loss through story, that stories, you feel that stories offer us something, these old folk tales and myths can offer us something around an experience such as death that our contemporary culture doesn't?
Totally. I think what it allows us to do is to demonstrate, again, the space to make meaning with, to know that the way that we grieve is deeply personal, deeply individual. There is no standard. There are structures, roughly, but actually it can look very different for people. And story provides us with the space to do that. So as part of the commission through CISF, I did some workshops. I said I'd do some workshops with people who work closely with bereavement and loss. So I did some work with professionals in hospices and in care settings, people who, you know, they're confronted by death on a daily basis, you know, or dying, let's say. And we, in the sort of R&D phase, we told them the Orpheus myth, because, you know, some people just don't know it. And what we found was the connection with the metaphorical kind of content of that story is vast, is so special, because people have got the space to feel a sense of empathy with a variety of different characters. And that empathy is coming from somewhere. It's coming from them internally, and they're connecting it with their own loved ones that they've lost, or people that they've met they've witnessed dying processes. So the story itself gives people the space to experience the feelings of grief and loss and memory of that, but in the safety of the story. It's that step removed. I'm not asking you to tell me about your loved one's death. That's not for me. You know, on an ethical level, we talk about applied storytelling. Who are we to go into spaces and say, tell me your stories? What right do we have? We don't. But what we can offer is a story that allows people to make those connections themselves and share the way that they want to share, and feel in control of their own narratives, because they are choosing to make those connections and choosing to share what they want to share. So story itself, I think is a really fantastic vehicle to support people through this. Just this, it's horrible. Like, it's horrible. And I don't think it gets easier for people. I just think that people are more comfortable with it hurting. And it comes back, you know, that hurt comes back. It doesn't go. It just changes and shifts over time. And a lot of the conversations I had with people were around, you know, they don't use the language of grief journey because it's just sort of constant. It's always there. It doesn't reach a destination point. You just live with it. And story offers those narratives of human experience, you know, and as much as we can't understand what it's like to be the son of a Greek god, and we can't imagine what it's like to go into the underworld, we know where the darkness lies in ourselves. Or we've seen people go into the dark, which links us a little bit back to applied storytelling and working with people who might have been to really dark places through drugs and alcohol addiction, whatever, and so on, that the stories allow them to resonate, even if it's a metaphor.
Amazing. Yeah, really nice to hear of that process of like straddling, yeah, or using applied storytelling and community engagement as a way of developing material for a theatre show. So really see that there's that breadth in the storytelling work you're doing.
I should give a shout out as well that during Orpheus, I was working with two fantastic musicians, Neil Wood and Heather Cartwright, and Heather sang the ballad throughout, and she's a fabulous guitarist. Neil's a brilliant harpist from the Folks Music Project. If you ever get a chance to engage with them in Glasgow, they're brilliant. And to have music at the center of things, providing the space, because I find music slows me down as well and allows the space to exist safely. So it's not silence. There's just this gentle music moving through. Just created this, it just crystallizes the imagery, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, and it helps create an atmosphere, doesn't it?
Offers
more. Yeah, really nice. I want to move on. I wonder if... I also don't know the story of Orpheus. I'm wondering if people do. Maybe I could just leave a link to that in the show notes if people want to go and check out the Orpheus myth.
It's a classic, and there's lots of different versions. And the part of my research, you know, you discover where it first comes about, and there's Ovid versions, and there's other versions. And there's also, I've discovered through telling, different folk versions from, there's an Indian version apparently, but you'll find it. So, I don't think it's wise for me to tell.
Yeah, there's part of me wants to tease it out of you, but then I know I want another story later. So that feels a bit greedy to be asking for a story after every
tell it
after every question. I also really associate you with children's storytelling, which is a slightly different art, right? Like telling to children is different from telling to teenagers or in a hospice, which is different to telling in a theatre to a contemporary paying audience. I saw your Feast of Fools show at the Edinburgh Fringe a couple of years ago. It was a lot of fun. It was slightly ridiculous. What I also enjoyed was that even though it was a show, the audience got to choose these two different story pathways. Did you have like, it was something like you had a nice story option and a horrible story option. Is that right? Or like sweet and disgusting? Or
there were two menus. So you chose menu A or B. Menu A was delicious and menu B was disgusting. And there was a starter, a main, and a dessert on each. And I presented the menus through a sandwich board that I held around my neck. And I played some music and did a bad dance and let people peruse the menu. And then they voted using the paper plates and napkins that are in front of them. And I can tell you, almost to my disappointment, that most people picked delicious. Like,
really?
I was trying to incite the disgusting. And I think actually the show you saw, you chose disgusting, didn't you?
I was on a disgusting day.
You were, but you, it was, a, I think it was,
I remember,
predominantly
was there a Japanese emperor with his bum sticking out?
Japanese emperor with his bum sticking out. Oh no, that was in that's in Delicious.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, there was
the Tanuki story of the tea kettle, the raccoon in the tea kettle. Yes. There's a lot of bums in my story. It's difficult to wade through which have bums and which do not. Yes. So the audience picked the menu and then that dictates tell. But through the story, there was also the occasional riddle and then toasts. We did toasts as well and tongue twisters to warm up our mouth. So it was playing a lot with different ways in which word is used in these sort of formal food-based environments, sort of banqueting kind of culture, I guess. It was a bit of a sort of anti-Burns in some respect.
Uh-huh. It was a really nice way of keeping something rooted in what I see as storytelling as opposed to theatre. Like having this interaction, having spontaneity, having responsiveness, like all of those feel like storytelling qualities that don't always show up in theatre. Yeah, the riddles. I tell you, I've got a riddle I just came across last week.
Go on. Do you want to do it here or do you want to not?
I'm going to do it right now.
Go on, please do.
And you can respond.
I'm going to write it down.
What I might do is edit out the time it takes for either of us to think of it so we don't look really stupid. I have one leg and my heart is in my head. What am I?
I have one leg and my heart is in my head.
And it's quite a difficult one, so I'm going to give you a clue. It is a foodie one. I have one leg and my heart is in my head.
Oh, is it artichoke?
You're really close.
Oh. Heart is in my head. Oh, no, well, I was quite confident then when I said artichoke.
Well, I tell you what, artichoke probably could be correct in a technicality. The answer in this book I found was cabbage.
Oh, yes, okay.
So same logic. I have one head, I have one leg. It's on one stalk, and the head of the cabbage has the heart inside it. You cut it open to the heart of the cabbage.
So, you know, in a way, I think artichoke's a better answer because it's got more stalk on it, hasn't it?
Well, that's how the oral tradition works. You carry that one on and it becomes an artichoke.
Great. No, that's good. I'll nick that. This is one that you'll know, but I'll do it anyway. I'm the part of the bird that's not in the sky. I can swim in the ocean, but still remain dry. What am I?
Say it again.
I'm the part of the bird that's not in the sky. I can swim in the ocean, but still remain dry. What am I?
It's not Captain Birdseye.
Oh, that's a good answer. No, he'd be soggy if he landed in the ocean.
Part
even with his fish fingers.
Part of a bird that's not in the sky.
Mm-hmm. I can swim in the ocean and still remain dry.
Oh, I've got no idea.
Really? Do you want to take a wild geek guess? What I always say with riddles is the best, nobody likes the person that gets it right first time. Getting it wrong is the point, I think, of riddles, more so than getting it right.
Part of a bird that stays in the sky.
I can give you a clue if you want.
Give me a clue.
Okay. What's the clue? Have you ever flown on a plane? I'm sure you do it less and less these days, but have you flown on a plane?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a time when you're on a plane, you look down and it's a clear day and there's a part of the plane on the ground or indeed the sea. What is it?
The shadow.
Yay! The shadow.
Oh, very nice.
The good thing about that riddle, especially with kids, is you get eggs, you get poo. They get an opportunity to say poo. And obviously that's funny universally. So, that's quite a nice one.
Good. Yeah, riddles are one of my favorite ways of warming up the space. Although, yeah, to my shame, I'm not as good at answering them as I would like
to
be.
No, I'm terrible. But the good thing about doing the riddles is quite infrequently you do them. So you can seem like the wisest one in the room when actually you are the most stupid.
Very nice. So, Feast of Fools, I understand it has developed. You now have a Fiesta of Fools, and the story you're going to tell us today is from that show. I guess we're getting close to story time.
Yeah. I mean, do you want me to just tell about Fiesta and then go into the story?
Yeah.
Would that be beneficial? Yeah. Do that. So Fiesta of Fools came out because I was developing a piece for Zwolle Unlimited, which is a festival in the Netherlands. And they were interested in this idea of foolishness. And I've always been interested in foolishness because I feel like it tells us a lot about our lives. Usually the most wisdom is contained within stupidity and fool tales. And we were just coming out of COVID, and I had spent a bit of COVID feeling sad about the loss of the stupid ways people connect, come together. So I wanted to create a piece that sort of made a nod to certain festivals around the world, which were stupid. So there's a festival in Spain where they jump over babies, newborn the babies have to be within a year, and the devil jumps over them. I was really interested in that idea. There's a festival in Cumbria, where I'm from, where you stick your head through what appears to be a toilet seat and you pull a face called Gurning.
Mm.
Interested in that. There was festivals all over the world with, you know, rolling, you know, chasing cheese or throwing things into places. You know, I wanted to do was create a piece that was about that. But ultimately, it turned into a bit of a love letter to Cumbria in some respects. Because I do miss it at points. Mm. And it was basically a journey of one character to the Gurning Festival in Egremont. But along the way, there are these encounters that bleed into story. And one of the first stories, and again, this piece had choice. So in the first iteration of the performance, there was a signpost that the character comes to, and one sign says sugar, and the other sign says salt. And I got the audience to choose. And depending on which way you chose, depending on the story that you got. And the story I'm going to tell is as if you have chosen salt. So whether you're ready for salt and it's your lunch or it's not, I don't care, because you're going to get lots of it. The story starts with Tom, or Tam, let's call him Tam. Tam is a young man, and he is desperate for luck, for anything to go his way. And he does all the tricks in the book. You know, he'll go out in autumn and he'll try and catch a leaf falling directly from a tree before it hits the ground. He'll find pennies that have got the same on each side. He'll be tossing coins in wells. He does everything he can, but so far, no luck whatsoever. And eventually, sitting down by the fire, he's sitting with his grandma, and his grandma looks up at him above her glasses, and she says, Tam, it's easy. The way you get a wish, the way you get what you want, is you need to sprinkle some salt on a magpie's tail. Mm-hmm. And you need to make that wish before the magpie flies off, because otherwise you'll not get it. Well, in a moment, Tam was up, he was out, he was filling his pockets with salt, and he was heading off into the forest. And he wandered into this forest and he chased magpies left, right and center. And I don't know if anybody out there has ever tried to put anything on a magpie's tail. It's not exactly easy. So he worked throughout the day until the sun was coming down over the horizon. And eventually he saw this little magpie that was showing a bit of an interest. And the magpie came up to him, turned its tail around to present itself to him. And then he was just about to sprinkle salt on the tail when, of course, the magpie flew up into the air, landed on a branch, and Tam was furious. And he shook his fist and he screamed into the wind and he said, "You are the worst. I've been trying to do this all day." And she said, she started to speak. She said, "Listen, Tam, I'm not just going to let you pour salt on my tail. There's something you have to get for me first. For you see, I am a princess, and I have been trapped in this magpie's body for too long, and I need to get out. What I need from you is I need a beautiful clasp knife. Bring me a beautiful clasp knife, and we'll do some talking." So Tam went away. He worked for 7 whole days, if not longer, trying to shape this beautiful clasp knife that was embroidered and emboldened with all sorts of wonderful words and silver lining. And then he took it back into the forest. And he showed the magpie, and the magpie looked at it with one eye and then looked at it with the other eye. And then she said, "It's all right, but I would have preferred the handle to be in gold." He said, "Okay, I'll get you a gold one." And she says, "No, I don't want that anymore. I want a beautiful sledge. I want a beautiful sleigh that I can ride down the snowy hills on." So Tam goes away, uses his clasp knife to carve this wood into a sleigh, and he works tirelessly with the knife to shape it and make it beautiful. He takes it back to the forest. The magpie takes a look, does that thing where you kind of kick the wheels a bit like you do with your car at home to see if it works. It doesn't do anything, but it makes it look like you do. Magpie kicks the rails that run alongside, and she said, "It's nice, but I could have really done with it to be a bit more beautiful than this for a princess like me." Tam says, "I'll go and get you one." He says, "I don't want that anymore. What I need is a beautiful carriage drawn by horses. That's what I would like." So off Tam goes, and he goes into the town. Of course, he takes his sledge with him, and he discovers that actually it's a pretty good ride, pretty good at getting down the hills. So he starts to set up on the snowy banks of the mountains, and people come from miles around to give him some money to slide down the hills. They're handing him wadges of cash to go again and again and again. As soon as the snow dissipates, he gets to work using that money to buy a rickety old carriage. He works on it all through the summer months, all through the spring months. And then in the summer, he rides it into the forest. Again, the magpie floats down, kicks the wheels, checks the horse's eyes, you know, the pink of its eyes. And then it says, "It's nice, but really the curtain should be velvet." And she says, "I'll get you one, I'll get you one." She said, "I don't want a horse-drawn carriage anymore. I need a castle in the center of the woods." So, of course, Tam leaves. He goes off, uses his carriage to sell rides through the town. People gather from all around, even the dukes, the dukesses, the earl and earlesses, they love to ride in this beautiful carriage across the town, across the cobbles. And he makes money hand over fist. Eventually, he's able to buy this small castle in the center of the forest. He goes to meet the magpie, leads the magpie to the castle. The magpie walks in, her breath is taken. And she says, "This is incredible. This is everything I could ever wish for. I am a princess and I deserve this." And he says, "Brilliant, will you let me sprinkle salt on your tail?" She says, "No, really, it's all very well and good having this castle, but I could do with three large cases of gold that sit in the center of this room. And then I'll be fine." With weariness in his shoulders. By now, Tam is older. He's a middle-aged man. And if you know anything about middle-aged men, they're beleaguered and frustrated at the whims of life. But still, he goes out. It doesn't take him long to sell his carriages. Maybe he rents out the castle as an Airbnb for a period of time to bring in hosts of money. And then, of course, in no time, he fills three great big cases. And he sits in the castle and he waits for the magpie to arrive. And when she does, she can't believe it. She says, "Go on then. Now's your chance." She flies down and sits by his feet. Tam reaches into his pocket because his pockets still have little pockets, bits of salt. He picks out the grains of salt. She presents herself. She wiggles her tail. He reaches his hands over and he's just about to sprinkle the salt on the tail when he realizes he doesn't know what to wish for. He sprinkles the salt on the tail and nothing comes. He thinks about everything he could possibly wish for and he can't think of anything. And she starts to count. "This isn't going to last forever, Tam," she says. "One," he says, "give me a minute." She says, "Two." "No, no, 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 I need longer, I need longer." "Three." And with that, she flies up to the window ledge. The salt cascades off her tail and Tam feels it almost land on his brow and he screams into the air with fury. He says, "I have wasted my life on you. You should have given me longer." Of course, the magpie explains, "Look around, Tam. There is a castle in a forest, three large chests of gold in your feet. You've got everything you could possibly wish for." And she flies away. And Tam slumps down in his chair and he looks at what he spent his life doing. And that's the end of the story. I like that story. Can I explain it? Is that right? Not explain it, but can
yeah,
I?
I'm
interested in it because story presents for me challenges on a kind of moral level lots of the time. Like, in a way, on the surface of that story, it's the ultimate capitalist dream. He like he works and works and works and then he ends up living off the fat of his but what has he spent his life doing other than pursuing a dream of a figment of imagination? Or do we feel connected to Tam because he's such a sort of fool at the beginning and or remains a fool and he actually deserves what he gets because he sort of let his nose lead him. He's let these ridiculous actions guide him through. And I kind of like that moral, the moral positioning of it.
Where does that story come from?
Well, this is another thing. I found it within a Swedish folk tales book. And this collection is beautiful, beautifully illustrated. And so it sits for me within a sort of Northern European forest. Mm. It's got real forest strength. Magpies, I kind of feel universal in this part of the world or Northern Europe, I guess.
A bit trickstery.
I like the fact that the princess trope shifts, like the magpie just says she is and it's bought.
Yeah,
like,
there's no marriage.
And there's no marriage. There's no sense of like she turns back. And that's your expectation, isn't it? Your expectation is she's going to turn back into a princess and they're going to be married. But that's not in the story. She just flies away. Yeah. And I like that it's just a suggestion that the magpie is just like, I'm a princess. And the lie is bought, you know, or is it true? I don't know.
And it's interesting you talk about this capitalist dream. It's like, it's interesting weighing up the satisfaction that he gets, you know, the castle, the carriage, the gold, all the way up from, you know, like renting out his sledge and carving with his own hands. And yet there's still a slight disappointment that the magic didn't happen when he sprinkled the salt on the magpie. And it's like, oh, wow, what would we trade in the story? Would we trade the castle to see what happens if the, you know, the salt was sprinkled in the magpie's tail and something magical happened?
Yeah. The pursuit of the magic is part of the niceness of it. And the possibility of the magic is quite nice, isn't it? Like, and that's where we're going. That's what's at stake. And that's what we follow to the point where we forget a little bit about what the original intention is. Like, they're busy on this journey. And then to be able to say at the end, oh, and now you can sprinkle salt on my tail. We're clicking back into that idea of what we're presented with at the beginning. And what do we hope to see as a listener or hear? Like, do we want this wish? Well, what is the wish that we want him to make? And I don't know. There's a lot going on in all in all stories. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's nice. And I think, as an audience who's also a storyteller, as I'm listening, I'm like, it sounds like I thought you'd found another version of The Man with No Luck.
Yes.
Where he goes on the journey. And then I thought you'd found another with the magpie's tail. I thought, you found another version of the bear's whisker or the lion's whisker.
Yes.
But actually the story ends up as, one I don't recognize. So for me, as someone who's a little bit seasoned in this world of storytelling, it's really fun to hear a fresh tale that I haven't even heard a version of before. So thanks for digging that out and personalizing it and sharing it with us today.
Absolute pleasure. Really nice. Really nice to just spend a little bit of time going back and forth, sharing a story, but also like just talking about some of the bigger things that are occurring. And a lot of the time I think about this stuff and it's difficult to get the vehicle to do it. So it's a real pleasure to do it here.
Great. It's makes me hark back to our afternoon coffees in the office in Pollock Shaw, where there would come a point where I think our brains were saturated with storytelling admin and it would be time to fill the cafetiere and spraff about these grand storytelling ideas.
Let's do that again. That sounds good. That sounds really good. At Fest, maybe.
Yes. So, winding out, tell us there's some significant things storytelling wise that are happening in Glasgow this year. Give us a bit of a heads up.
Yeah. So the big thing that we're already working towards is the Village Storytelling Festival 2024, which is happening between the 25th and 30th of June, where there'll be loads of performances from across Scotland and Europe and down south as well, that celebrate this theme of language and identity. But inside of the festival, we're also hosting Fest. The FEST conference, the Federation of European Storytelling, which is a 3-day long extravaganza of discussion points around the art form from European wide storytellers and story adjacent promoters and practitioners who are looking to engage with some of these things that we're talking about and more so. So in that same week, there will be opportunities to not only see performance, but to engage with workshops and discussion points. Obviously, you need to get yourself a Fest ticket. So go on put in Fest conference into your search engines and get it, and then keep your eyes peeled for the Village Storytelling Festival. There'll be two new commissions for that festival. So two new pieces from Scottish-based or Glasgow-based artists, storytellers, and we're also going to be hosting our emerging storytellers storytelling night to try and encourage new voices stepping into the art form that feel fresh, that are perhaps from more underrepresented groups as well, which is definitely needed. So all the stuff is being geared towards that. Most of the events are at the CCA in Glasgow.
And what are the dates again, just to clarify?
25th to the 30th of June. So the 25th is a Tuesday, first performance Tuesday night. And then the mini fest, which is in Pollock, is on the 30th, which is where our big community day with the groups that we work with on a daily basis coming together to sort of celebrate in the glorious sunshine.
Yeah. So if you're in the process of pondering your summer holiday options, Glasgow late June sounds like a good option.
Saturday will be a family day as well. So, and that's right at the beginning of the school holidays. So if you're looking for things to do with the Wanes, it's probably quite a good.
Bring your kids. But there'll be a right gathering of people from across Europe, and storytelling performance, storytelling talks, workshops. It'd be a great way to immerse yourself in what's happening storytelling wise in Europe in Glasgow at the end of June for anyone that fancies it.
Perfect.
So thanks, Dan. Really nice to catch up. Thanks for all those stories and musings and commentary on community work and theatre and everything in between.
It's been a pleasure. It's really nice doing it. I can't wait to get this cafetiere.
Let's do it again. It's a date. So that was my chat with Dan. Hopefully you enjoyed it, found something useful and entertaining in it. If you want to find out more about his work, you can check his website out, Dan the Story Man. You may want to go and look at the Village Storytelling Centre and check out their upcoming festival or some of the local storytelling opportunities they have in the west of Scotland. Or check out the Federation for European Storytelling, because their annual gathering will be in Scotland this year. It'll be a fine gathering, people from all over Europe coming to talk about stories, to share stories, to explore this contemporary storytelling movement. I'm pretty certain that's where I'll be at the end of June. I do have some various bits and pieces brewing in the background. The best way to stay up to date is to join my mailing list, which is linked in the show notes. So if you're curious about what I'll be up to storytelling-wise through the year, join the mailing list, or maybe you could check me out on Instagram at Dougie Mackay Story. The big thing I'm building up for is a little storytelling tour of Vancouver. Yeah, Vancouver Island, Vancouver itself, maybe down into Washington State. So if you're in that part of the world on the Pacific coast, I'll be there May through till June doing a mix of Scottish storytelling shows and also myth as medicine workshops. We're going to build up to a four-day intensive myth as medicine retreat in June. So could be worth traveling for, actually. If you're somewhere semi-local, you might want to get yourself across to BC. We're going to be having a right old storytelling Kaylee there from May through till June. I've got another online offering coming up, a kind of year-long program working with an Irish herbalist, where we'll go through the kind of old Celtic festivals, the eight old festivals at different points of the year, and exploring the plants, the herbs, the trees, the folklore, and the stories associated with those old festivals. It'll be a really nice way to, yeah, get a bit closer to the old Celtic way of seeing the world and tuning into the natural cycles. Over the next few weeks, a few more developments. I've got a new bi-monthly storytelling and music night starting at the Scottish Storytelling Centre. It's called the Hearthfire Sessions. The first one is on March the 21st. And yeah, got a really good lineup of storytellers, musicians, circus artists. That's going to be an eclectic kind of Kaylee style night happening every 2 months. 21st of March, we're back on the 9th of May. There will be more in July, September, November. So if you're around Edinburgh in those months, come along, check it out, say hi. And finally, I'm going to be going to the studio in a week. In the next week, I'm going to a studio to record my Scottish Tales for Telling collection. It was really generously supported through Kickstarter. And yeah, I'm really excited to record a handful of my favourite Scottish tales. So if you're interested in that, again, send us a message, join the mailing list, and that will be available for public purchase very, very soon. So that's about it for now. Thanks for sticking with us in this slightly longer episode. Thanks for your attention. As always, feedback is appreciated. Feel free to leave a review, leave a comment, send us a message. Feel free to share this podcast with your friends, anyone else that you think might be into gnarly old tales and Scottish culture. And until next time, wishing you all the best.